Recently, the North Carolina Justice Center released its annual State of Working report describing how things are for working people in North Carolina. What are the positives? What are the challenges? And what needs to be done to address them? NCJustice.org is the website for the North Carolina Justice Center. You can go there, get more information, and download the full report. Patrick McHugh joins us on the phone right now. He's the research manager for the Budget and Tax Center at the NC Justice Center, and he's also the primary author of this year's State of Working Report. Patrick, thank you so much for being with us today. How are you?
Oh, doing as well as can be hoped, I suppose, in these times. Always good to talk to you, Aaron.
Absolutely. So let's start with the very beginning of the report and just kind of walk through it. This year's report really focuses heavily in terms of the state of working in North Carolina today, obviously on COVID-19 and the impacts that it's having on working people in general and the disproportionate impacts it's having on lower income people and people of color in particular. So what are the key takeaways from that section?
Well, the first thing I think that is worthy of attention is that COVID-19, there are some unique impacts to COVID-19, but in many regards, this pandemic and this crisis is just revealing some deep structural problems that existed in our economy before the crisis came along, and unfortunately is sort of exacerbating them. And the first thing that we should recognize is that COVID-19 puts working people, and particularly people of color and women and folks paid the worst wages in North Carolina, in just a heck of a bind in this way. It's both true that low-income folks and people of color and women are more likely to have lost a job as a result of the pandemic, and at the same time are more likely to be on the front lines of COVID-19 in jobs that put them at real physical risk. So it's a really vicious sort of paradox where you're either the folks that are sort of on the margins of our economy that are paid the worst wages are more likely to have lost a job, or if they're still working, are more likely to be in positions that are really hard to do remotely or impossible to do remotely, and where the risk, the physical risk of being exposed to COVID-19 is particularly dramatic. And that has a lot to do, again, this is unique to COVID-19 in the sense of the sort of physical risk of a pandemic. But a lot of that has to do with a failing to create the sort of career ladders and opportunities for people to get out of low wage work, out of the retail and hospitality sectors that have been the most impacted in terms of job losses, but also where, again, folks are at physical risk of contracting COVID-19. And this is one of the things that's different for this pandemic compared to, say, the Great Recession, is particularly along lines of gender, where in the Great Recession, men were more likely to lose a job as a result of that because the nature of that financial crisis concentrated the economic hit in industries like construction and manufacturing, where men tend to be overrepresented as part of the labor force. This time around, a lot of the occupations in, again, retail, personal services, childcare, healthcare, those sorts of positions are more likely to be staffed by women. And so if you look at the unemployment insurance claims, for example, the share of claims that have been filed throughout this pandemic that are being filed by women are disproportionate to their share of the labor force. So there are some features of this that are unique to this particular pandemic.
And we know the health impacts, obviously, of going to work and putting yourself on the line in terms of increasing your risk of getting COVID-19. Another thing, though, that you also cover in the report is the impact that all of this is having on the enforcement of health and safety standards, right?
Absolutely. And this is definitely one of the most tragic chapters of this crisis, is that we've seen an almost complete failure of the oversight and regulatory apparatus that should be protecting people in this moment, both at the state and particularly the federal level. You know, we've seen no binding guidance, no binding regulations that require employers to adjust their practices so that they can protect the health and safety of their workforce. So, for example, you know, one of the, and in many of these jobs are the jobs, again, that we rely upon every single day for the functioning of society. You know, the entire food production system, we've seen almost no enforcement of basic health and safety regulations, and certainly not the promulgation of new regulations that would reflect the unique features of COVID-19. So there's been no, you know, new regulations issued that would require adequate social distancing in meat processing plants, for example. So we're seeing folks packed, you know, cheek to jowl, making sure that food gets on our table, but in the process, putting themselves at enormous physical risk in jobs often that were already deeply dangerous, even in the absence of a pandemic. And this is something where we've seen some very vague guidance, but no binding regulation coming from the federal government, and almost no follow-up enforcement activity when workers who are frightened for their lives and for the lives of their families that they may be taking the bug home to complain about being packed into unsafe working conditions. There's just been very little, and certainly nothing approaching adequate enforcement to see to it that employers are protecting the basic health and safety of their workers. And again, unfortunately, a lot of the folks that are being put in this predicament, a lot of the working people who are being exposed to this deadly virus, are people of color. And again, that's sort of reflective of an existing structural inequality that existed in our economy that's only being made more visible and exacerbated by the COVID-19 crisis.
Speaking with Patrick McHugh again, North Carolina Justice Center, primary author of the State of Working Report, which we're talking about right now. Go to ncjustice.org to get more information about the Justice Center and also to download the full report, which is an annual report, but it's a little bit unique this year insofar as this year you focus really heavily not just on what's happening today, but also just the history of working in North Carolina and labor in North Carolina. Carolina and the labor movement in North Carolina and changes that have been made or not made in the past. What are, and I know this is asking you to cover 400 years of history in a minute, but what are some of the key moments from that history that are impacting us today?
Well, the first thing is that the problems that we're seeing that we were just talking about in terms of low wages and the structural racism inherent in our economy, none of this happened by accident. This was the consequence of, as you note, hundreds of years of history and intentional policy decisions. And so while that is tragic that we haven't overcome the history of and the legacy and the present reality of racism in this country, it also means that there's things we can do about it. And I guess that's one of the other things that I think is really important to recognize is North Carolina has a really incredible and often deeply underappreciated labor organizing history. Some of the most important labor actions in the history of the United States happened here in North Carolina. And because we are a right to work for less state, where a lot of the labor protections that working people in other states enjoy are muted or undermined, often intentionally, we often don't fully appreciate the role that North Carolina played in the creation, essentially, of the modern middle class and of the labor protections that exist in this country. So a couple sort of quick things that I think are worth sort of looking back into history. So the first thing is, it was actually a strike that happened up and down the eastern seaboard, including in North Carolina and a lot of the South, that precipitated a lot of the basic New Deal legislation that happened in the wake of the Great Depression, that gave us things that we now consider, often don't even think about as basic worker protections, whether that be the minimum wage or the right to organize or maximum work hour regulations. A lot of these came out of and in response to the general cotton mill, the general textile strike of 1934, where hundreds of thousands of textile workers up and down the Eastern Seaboard walked off the job in response to oppressive conditions, terrible pay, incredibly dangerous working conditions that had been made worse by business practices during the Great Depression. And it was in part as a response to the violence that met protesters and the strikers demanding a basic fair shake in their working conditions. The violence meted out on the part of a lot of the mill owners and some of the local authorities that supported them that essentially compelled the Roosevelt administration to say, you know what, we can't trust the captains of industry to manage their own labor disputes. We're tired of seeing protesters gunned down in the streets en masse. And so that led to the right to organize and the outlawing of a range of sort of dirty practices that were used to break unions and to frustrate unionization organizing. It also led to the creation of the unemployment insurance system. Now, this is something that I think is particularly relevant and very much underappreciated, is that while the New Deal was an incredible step forward for working people in this country, it was also made rigorously irrelevant to the vast majority of Black people working in the South, very explicitly done by Southern segregationist elected leaders to preserve the system of Jim Crow. And the way that was done was virtually all of the basic protections included in the New Deal, whether that be Social Security insurance, unemployment insurance, the minimum wage, and others, the right to organize, were exempted for domestic workers and agricultural workers, who just so happened to represent the vast majority of Black working people in the South. And this was no accident. And everybody at the time knew precisely what was being done, is that in order to pass the New Deal, the Roosevelt administration essentially had to strike this terribly Faustian bargain to get the support of Southern Democratic members of Congress, who controlled many of the key committee chairmanships at the time, that would essentially exempt or make irrelevant for most Black working people in the South the basic protections of the New Deal. Now, why is that still relevant to this moment? First of all, many of those exemptions still exist. So it's still incredibly difficult for a lot of domestic workers and agricultural workers to gain the basic protections of union protection. But in particular, when it comes to unemployment insurance, in addition to at the time exempting domestic and agricultural workers from being eligible for unemployment insurance, they also at the time made it a state and locally administered program. And if you think about it, in the absence of trying to preserve Jim Crow, it doesn't make any sense. This is a piece of federal legislation. Why should it be up to state governments and local administrative bodies to collect, process unemployment insurance claims and to set unemployment insurance benefits? This was done at the time explicitly so that state and local authorities would have more ability to prevent even those few Black working people who were eligible from receiving unemployment insurance. Now, why is that particularly relevant in the current moment? The result of that is that we now have this patchwork of state unemployment insurance systems that put working people in this moment in a bind in two ways, at least two ways. First of all, in states like North Carolina that have incredibly meager unemployment insurance benefits, both in terms of the maximum weekly benefit and the duration of those benefits. That means that when the federal supplementary unemployment insurance benefits that were passed as part of the CARES Act expired, folks that had been making do on those supplementary benefits were now at immediate risk of losing their homes, not being able to feed their children, not being able to pay for the basic necessities of life. It also means that we have to update the state unemployment insurance filing system every time there's a change in federal policy, whether that be when the original supplementary benefits were enacted as part of the CARES Act, or this very short-term fix that was done with the disaster funding. That means that every state, including North Carolina, has to go into its administrative computing system and update that system. And as a result of that, as unfortunately far too many North Carolinians have experienced, it creates incredible delays in people who are eligible for these additional federal benefits to be able to receive them. And again, these are a lot of folks that suddenly the world turned on its head underneath them and found themselves without a job, trying to figure out how to keep food on the table and keep their mortgage or rent paid in the middle of a crisis, and are having to wait weeks and sometimes even months to receive the basic federal unemployment insurance system or benefits that they're entitled to. None of that would have been necessarily the case if it weren't for the legacy of this intentionally racist policy that was passed as part of the New Deal, where the unemployment insurance system was administered at the state and local level. So these legacies, we often think about Jim Crow as something that happened generations ago, even though that's not really true. This is not ancient history, and the legacies of policy decisions that were made in the 1930s and before and after are still very much present with us today, and are greatly increasing the harm and the suffering that a lot of working people are experiencing as a result of COVID-19.
Speaking with Patrick McHugh, and Patrick, we got to wrap up, but bringing it forward to today really quickly, the end of the report that you co-wrote talks about next steps right now in 2020 and beyond. What are some of the key ones that we should be fighting for?
Well, I think that as much as this is a crisis, there's also opportunity to rethink and rebuild how our economy functions better coming out of this. The sad fact is that our society rarely makes major steps to the good during times of peace and tranquility. So this is a moment where I think that the upside of this is that a lot of people are increasingly cognizant of how their daily lives are dependent upon people who are the most exposed to the harms of an economy that delivers the greatest benefits to a tiny fraction of extremely wealthy households, and an economy where a lot of people lack the basic sort of health and safety protections that a lot of us take for granted. So the first thing is to get involved with a lot of the amazing labor organizing that is happening in this state and around the country right now. There's a lot of movements that are happening that have been building power for some time that have the potential to come out of this a lot stronger. And the second is to demand an even more strident voices that our elected representatives really take a hard look at some of these deep structural problems. You know, the fact that we have some of the least adequate labor protection laws in the country in North Carolina is a major reason that a lot of people don't have access to basic health and safety and decent wages running into this. That's something we can change here in North Carolina. The fact that we have an unemployment insurance system that's so woefully inadequate, even in the face of a normal economic recession, let alone something, a catastrophe of this magnitude, is something that we can change here in North Carolina. So it's important to think about what happens in DC, but it's also really important to put pressure on our state and local elected leaders to do what's right for North Carolinians and the working people that deserve a better and fairer shake in this economy.
The report is the State of Working North Carolina Report. You can get the full thing online at ncjustice.org. That's the website for the North Carolina Justice Center. Patrick McHugh, thank you so much for being with us today.
All right. Absolutely. Take care.